Homage to the Buddha, homage to the Dharma, homage to the Sangha. Good morning.
Good morning.
I want to start by thanking Domyo and Shintai for inviting me this morning. I'm delighted to be here, delighted to see how this place is thriving. Does my heart good?
Mention this is my teacher. And Shintai's teacher. I guess we could have done some introductions.
I've been thinking recently about what is important in our practice life. I have been teaching for about 40 years now. And I recently retired as abbot of Dharma Rain Zen Center, which gives me a lot more latitude in my daily life and in my practice life. So being a full-time monastic, you're expected to go to everything, to be on the spot all the time. And now I'm not. but I still consider myself a person of practice.
And I have gratitude for what the practice has done for me. Are we having audio problems?
We are. Is the green light
on
the microphone?
Anymore.
Oh,
batteries.
Oh no.
Should I wait or continue?
We can hear you.
Can you hear me?
Okay. So the real joy is that I don't have to go to business meetings anymore. But there's still the question, what am I called to do? And I recognize that, you know, for most people in their lay lives, you know, that's because you have other obligations and you have flexibility in how you do your practice, it becomes a question. What am I called? How much am I called to do? And what is important for me to do? So why do we do this practice? Well, I know for me,
I'm surrounded by electronics. So I know for me that I came to this practice because I knew I was in a bad way. Facing reality and relieving suffering are basic tenets of Buddhism. It's important that at some point early in our practice we recognize that we are suffering beings, that there are parts of our life that are just unsatisfactory. They're not the way we would like them to be. And that causes us different kinds of discomfort at different times. And accepting that is important. I have another student who confessed in a student talk that when he came to this practice, he thought, suffering? Well, that's all you little people. I grew up in a stable family and, you know, got through college and have this fantastic career and make tons of money and I'm sane, I've got it all taped. It took him a while to realize, oh, I too am a suffering being. I didn't have any problem identifying that I was a suffering being when I came to Buddhism. I'd been seriously depressed for years. And therapy and drugs were not making that much of a difference. But from the time I had the first experience of practice that I felt was real, that was actually making a difference in the way I saw the world, I was committed. You couldn't pry me away from Buddhism with a crowbar. Once I saw that actually this practice is potent, it can change lives. And what was important to me is it can change my life. But even though I was committed, there was very little of this practice that came easy for me. My back is curved. I don't sit up straight. I sprained my ankle trying to sit half lotus. I was pretty good at keeping silence, but I was not good at speaking with confidence. And over time, some of these things became easier. But all along the way, the difficulties showed me some of my stuck places. Places where my habit energy, my habits of mind in particular, although I thought of myself as flexible, very often what I was labeling as flexible was just indifference. And when, for instance, I was served food that I really disliked, my so-called flexibility was revealed to me to be a sham. You never had that problem, did you? And because I thought of myself as compassionate, my mother always told me I was so kind, I was confronted with people who irritated me, and I was shocked at how angry and judgmental I became. It's like, oh. And I never thought of myself as bossy. She laughs. But my first job at the monastery was working with goats, and it didn't take very long for those goats to irritate me to the point of rage. When I found myself wanting to kick the lead goat in the belly just because she was not cooperating, I realized, where's your compassion now, girly girl? So because the formality of the practice environment, whether you're just in it for an hour a week or you're in it 24/7, the formality of this practice environment presents you with opportunities to see things that irritate, to see things that you carry around in your mind, attitudes that you carry around with you wherever you are. But this is the great mirror. This is where you get to see that content of your mind in its glory and in its less acceptable forms. The formality of the practice environment I had in the monastery did not give me any way to remove myself from things that irritated. I either had to face them or explode. My teacher liked to point out that even in China, Japan, and Korea, practitioners are challenged to conform to practices that are not comfortably congruent with cultural norms. By that I mean they eat oryoki meals in a monastery 3 times a day, or 2 times a day at least. And oryoki meals are, you know, a set of bowls, and you're given 2 opportunities to put things in your bowls, and everything you put in your bowl has to be eaten up, and it's a set period of time that you have to do this, and you're served what you're served, whether you like it or not. This is not the way a Japanese family has dinner together. This is the way you do it in the monastery. It's not the way you do it in China, in Korea, at a restaurant or with your family. And so learning to do that in the monastery is one of these things that is challenging. Sitting on the floor without moving is odd, even among those who usually sit on the floor or squat. Meals eaten in silence is very odd for many Asians. Putting your shoes straight, that's pretty common in Japan. Can be pretty odd for us. But our practice seems designed to put us off our game. Whatever our comfort realm is, whatever our habits are, the way we normally go through our day, the practice environment is just a little off from that. It's just a little different. Plus, you take away smartphones, tablets, computers, music, and face a wall in silence for 30 minutes. There's nothing there but the content of your mind. And not everything in the mind is sweetness and light. And who do we get to blame for that? But the practice is not there just to make us uncomfortable. It's to help us on a higher goal. And I like to put it to be more completely who we are in our true nature, or our Buddha nature, however you want to say that. It's to get us closer to that. And that Buddha nature is kind, is compassionate, is patient, is accepting. Generous and confident. And although, as I could do, telling myself I was compassionate and getting reinforced for the small acts of kindness I did do, it was not completely honest with myself. And so part of this coming into relationship to our Buddha nature is to be really true. To be honest and authentic. And then, hopefully, we get more in touch with the one who is compassionate and generous and accepting and confident. As I discovered in my early years of meditation, these qualities do not shine forth just because we decide that's what we want. They get a chance when we can truly acknowledge the habits that complicate our relationship with that higher self. The awkwardness of our practice pushes us out of the realm where our coping mechanisms, habits, and storylines are less efficient at maintaining a fiction about who we are. In a time of crisis, and I've seen a bunch, in a time of crisis, natural disaster, death in the family, whatever, the flow of our lives is interrupted. And if you've ever been at the scene of one of these interruptions, you can see that some people shine forth as helpers and caretakers, dealing with the reality of the situation and being supportive. And some people reveal a fearful, self-centered attitude that is unhelpful and potentially hurtful. I've seen so many families torn apart at the death of a parent. Where some people are fearful and self-centered and unhelpful and hurtful of each other. So I'm bringing that up as a metaphor, in a sense, for what our practice does. It interrupts the flow of our life. Even for an hour, it's interrupted by our meditation, by our putting our shoes straight, by our greeting each other with acceptance and kindness, even strangers, even people that on the surface look like somebody you don't want to associate with. And being kind and accepting and generous in that is our practice, even when it interrupts our preferences. Our practice is a gentle form of interruption that helps to reveal both sides of our character, the one that we're proud of and the one that we're happy to sweep under the rug. And it guides us to transformation. Some of the practices we use in the Zendo are showing us how we would act as a person of practice. How we would act when we were really in touch with that Buddha nature. How to act as if we were our better selves, even while on the inside we are grumbly, petty, or racked with disdain. Putting our shoes straight, bowing, fluffing up your zafu. These are acts of respect for things and people and the room we occupy together. Speaking kindly to any and every person who come to Bright Way is practicing non-judgmental acceptance, even if there is a niggling judgment forming on the inside. Practicing these forms and conforming to these expectations of behavior are ways of educating ourselves about both the ways in which we are not yet bodhisattvas and about how our Buddha nature looks when she shines. Becoming a person of practice means allowing these forms of practice to become familiar, habitual. Becoming a person of practice is an act of self-care. And becoming a person of practice is an activity both of self-respect and other respect. Because when we open to practice and allow it to seep in, we discover that there really is no hard line between this body and that body and that body and that body. We are breathing the same air. We are living the same life together. And so your self-respect and other respect are not two separate things. William James said something like, act as if everything you do matters because it does. That is a person of practice speaking. Putting your shoes straight matters. Making your bed matters. Washing the dishes matters. Speaking kindly to the grocery clerk matters. Bukai gave a talk some months back in which she talked about the practice of making the bed every morning. We might do a practice like that because we don't want other people to think we're slobs. But it can also be done as a gift to your future self. When I get rushed and I don't get my bed made in the morning, and there's a pile of clothes on the floor, and there's dirty dishes in the sink, I come back home, and I'm unhappy. And my cluttered environment feeds my cluttered mind, which is usually pretty cluttered anyway, so I don't need any help in that direction. When I get flustered, confused, disoriented, discombobulated, I am much more likely to forget my keys, to lose my glasses, to get annoyed. But if I can take the time to clean up my environment where I live as I go, I can more easily access that better self that I know is there, even when I'm in a bad mood. And if I come back to my messy nest, I can realize that I am not taking care of me. I am not taking care of my environment. I am not taking care of my housemate. And I am acting disrespectfully. When I make my bed, do my dishes, pay my bills on time, put my shoes straight, take out the trash, I'm caring for the forms of living. Forms of living an ordered life, not just conforming, but honoring, respecting my life, respecting my home, respecting my current self, and respecting my future self, the one that's going to go out and come back to this. I'm also respecting the neighbor who might show up at my door at any time. And I am respecting the people who provide services for me. The power company, the garbage man, the mail carrier. And I am caring for my small section of the planet. Not in a big way, but in those little ways that show that you care. And by fully inhabiting my life and caring for the things in my environment, I am activating the respect that does not distinguish between self and other. And from that place grows confidence. This is the wellspring of self-respect. That's my short little talk for today. Any comments, questions, or complaints?
I'm gonna go clean my house.
Okay.
Can you talk about the process of how you came to discover the difference between indifference and flexibility? Was that like a flash of light, or was that over a long period of time?
It was more over a period of time. I'm a slow learner, and it took more than one little incident of irritation before I could really own the inflexibility that was there all the time. I think the thing with the goats, that was more a moment of, oh my gosh, sudden clarity, is that I actually came into the monastery with the thought, with the long-held belief that I did not get angry. So the goats were great teachers for me. And then I found many other instances where I put that teaching into practice, where I realized, oh, I not only can get irritated, I can get enraged. And I need to own that and start working with it.
When I'm paying attention and I'm trying to practice lack of a preference, the words that are in my mind, unfortunately, are I don't care and it doesn't matter. And that doesn't sound like it's consistent with the kind of practice you're doing.
No. And I come back to William James. It matters. And whether it's external, whether you're acting out your irritation or just harboring it inside, it still matters. That doesn't mean you get to snap your fingers and just shut it off. But our practice is to be authentic. So recognizing first that you've got this voice that says it doesn't matter. Don't get into an argument with that voice. It's not going to help. It just increases the amount of time that you spend wrestling with it. But just coming back to noticing, oh, I've got that going on now. This is becoming authentic with who you are. At some point, if you do that noticing often enough, you can get to the point where, oh, I don't have to think that thought. I don't have to carry that thought. But we don't get to that place without an awful lot of just recognizing, here it comes again.
This may be related to what you just said, but one of the terms you came up with or said today was habit mind. Mm-hmm. And I've been thinking about that a little bit in terms of how pervasive it really is in all our lives. And what I'm struggling with is, I suppose, is recognizing the level and depth of those habits.
Yeah.
And how to really get into that. One idea is renunciation, and that's something I'm going to be working on these days. But anything you want to say on that area?
We often use the metaphor of a rutted dirt road. So you can know the ruts are there and decide to steer your cart so that it stays just offside of those. But chances are you're going to hit a little bump or a blip along the way and boom, you're back in the ruts again. So it doesn't matter what we're talking about. You know, this can be raging alcoholism, or it can be picking your nose. I don't care. But when you have traveled down a particular set of actions enough times, they wear a rut that you are very likely to go down a kajillion more times. And so, bringing awareness to the fact, oh, I'm in the rut again, it's not fun, but it is also useful. And the more time you can spend steering your cart so that it doesn't fall in those ruts, the more you are tending toward making a new habit. But it's like erosion. It doesn't often happen quickly. We're talking years, usually. And depending on how deep those ruts are, how deeply you have been, how long you have been, and how dedicated you have been into building up that set of habits. What do you mean, renunciation?
Well, I think by that I mean part of the issue, I think, for me is identifying all the habits mm-hmm. that are maybe subtle in some ways. Mm-hmm. And I have this idea recently that, for example, I'm planning on not eating any animals today or eating a certain way. Well, that's a pretty well-worn path for me. And but yet I think there's something to be discovered in going down that path.
Mm-hmm.
And something about habits. And maybe it'll open up other avenues of have it.
So I would substitute the word interruption in what you're calling renunciation. Is that you're identifying habits and you're trying to interrupt them by going in a different direction. It may not be the direction that you want to go in long term, but interrupting that flow that you've identified as problematic, that's a good thing. Sometimes I tell people if you have a way that you get yourself into trouble over and over again, you need to bring your awareness to that set of circumstances and find some compassion for yourself, because it doesn't help to beat yourself up over your problems. These ladies know this. It helps if you give yourself credit for the best that you can do in the circumstance. So you may find that you have fallen into one of your habits and you're 3 days into it. You give yourself credit for noticing, even 3 days into it, 3 months into it, I don't care. You give yourself credit for noticing. And that little bit of positivity that you're bringing to the noticing means you can start catching it earlier and earlier and earlier in the process. When you get proficient at this, however long that takes, then you have an opportunity to do a different action right when the impulse comes. And what I tell people is, I don't care if it's standing on your head and wiggling your ears, you know, doing something different at that point is interrupting the pattern. You can get more skillful at picking a road to go after you have learned to interrupt the pattern.
That makes a lot of sense.
Okay.
On the subject of those interruptions, I have recently taken to very odd behaviors for me, trying to interrupt very small daily routines, like brushing my teeth with my offhand or, anything, putting my pants up with the opposite leg. So small interruptions. I'm starting to, I guess, kind of doubt the value of interrupting with small things when I have so many large things to interrupt.
Mm-hmm.
I wonder if you have any insight. I believe you when you tell me that it matters. But I don't know that I believe that it matters as much yet.
But what you are doing is, by interrupting those small things, you're teaching yourself to be mindful, to really bring your attention to the task. Because if you brush your teeth out of habit, because you've always brushed your teeth that way, your mind can shut off. You're not making any decisions. It's all automatic. But by changing the way you do it, then there are a dozen points of decision making along the way, and you're bringing your mind to bear on the whole process. So what you're doing is training yourself in mindfulness. And that can be a muscle that you use to deal with some of the bigger issues.
That makes a lot of sense. Thank you.
Mm-hmm. I recently had a trip to Japan and was really struck by, it's a homogeneous culture, but there's no litter and it's clean, and to the point where, you know, you want your room in the hotel to be clean because the maid's coming in. And it's mm-hmm. such a different ambiance, mm-hmm. and everyone is incredibly light, which is so different than where we are, where mm-hmm. it's sort of like, well, whatever. But mm-hmm. there is no whatever, you know, you just wouldn't drop your soda can on the subway floor. So it made you so conscious of mm-hmm. your neighbors and, you know, everyone. Mm-hmm. And so culturally, they're in a sort of a different spot. We're kind of like teenagers mm-hmm. catching up. Mm-hmm. And I think that's why mindfulness is so prevalent in our talk, is that we need to be aware mm-hmm. where some other cultures are hyper aware mm-hmm. and they're trying to mellow out. You know? So it's an interesting cultural yeah. thing to step into.
Yeah. Thank you.
Your talk. My question, with all of the wrestling you've been doing with all of these inner demons, the one that I find challenging is the internal judge, mm-hmm. superego critic. You touched on it in many of the things that you mm-hmm. spoke about, but I'd be curious if you have more to say on that subject.
I think whether we acknowledge it or not, most people have trouble with that one. I think that the best practice I know for eroding the toxicity of that is metta practice. Mm-hmm. Have you been introduced to that one?
Yes.
Starting with just really nurturing your sense of safety and trust and wellness right where you sit, and just really conjuring the sensation and the trust that you are well, you are safe, you are supported right where you are. And then once you feel confident that this is true, you're not just making up words and telling them to yourself, but it's really true, then you see if you can expand that to include somebody you love. Or I tell people, if you really have a hard time with people, you know, picture a puppy dog, picture a bunny. You know, whatever you can extend that warmth to, that sense of wellness and protection. You know, you just go as far as you can. And over time, and this can take years or decades, you can start including people for whom you have some antipathy. But don't start there. You just quickly get yourself in a mess. But if you can start with the easy ones and be more expansive, where you're headed is less of a distinction between self and other. But you do that in baby steps. Yeah.
And what about when the hardest person to extend metta to is yourself?
That is tough. That is tough. I've actually got somebody that I'm working with that, you know, that's the biggie. And so the starting place for metta is, you know, where he's going to be a long time, because he just doesn't trust doesn't feel supported, doesn't feel worthy of support. So therapy, finding friends that do support is important. And yeah, getting a bunny rabbit. I think we might be done.
The universe is as the boundless sky. Just as the water is not wetted, the lotus is not wetted by the water that surrounds it. The mind is immaculate and beyond the dust. Let us bow to the highest Lord.